this is a huge problem I have with so much of the yoga and the mindfulness communities, this notion that we ought to have an acceptance that spreads everywhere. We ought to be at peace no matter what, period, full stop. And I think that's an unfair caricature on my part to a certain extent, but I don't want a sense of peacefulness that spreads everywhere, period, full stop. I want a sense of peace where it is okay for us to be at peace. And I want to be able to work for change around the many things in our world that need to change, and to be able to support other people in working to change the aspects of their world that need to change.
Hey, my friends, this is Nishant, and welcome to the Nishant Girl Show. This is a podcast about helping you live a fulfilled life, and my job on this show is to invite world-class experts to extract the practices, routines, and habits to help you live a fulfilled and abundant life. Today's guest is Sam Chase. Sam designs and delivers programs in mindfulness, yoga, and resilience for organizations nationwide. After studying economics and English, he finished at the top of his class and went on to compete for the International Rhodes and Marshall scholarships. He won and then ultimately declined the award to pursue the work he continues today, exploring the science of the human mind and the tools that help people lead flourishing lives. He brings that study back to the real world through his work with organizations including the United Nations, the National Guard, Columbia Medical School, and numerous others. He is the author of Yoga and the Pursuit of Happiness, a book that bridges the ivory tower research and esoteric philosophy surrounding meditation in a down-to-earth style that helps everyday people build an accessible transformative practice. He is certified to teach by the Kripalu Center for Yoga and Health, the largest yoga center in the nation. Without further ado, please enjoy this wide-ranging, uncommon conversation with Sam. Sam, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
My pleasure. I was wondering if we could start with your education and studying economics and English. What happened? You declined international awards. Could you please speak on that?
Oh, sure. Well, you know, I grew up pretty nerdy and pretty comically unathletic. I had horrible asthma as a child, so my body was always betraying me. But my brain seemed to work all right. And I was just a very academic kid and kind of grew up going from one class and one test to another and learned how to thrive in that way. And when I got to university, I was studying economics and English and enjoyed it quite a lot. I thought that I would go into game theory, which was my field of study. It's a really math-heavy discipline in economics. If you've ever seen the movie, The Book of Beautiful Mind, that's the field that I was studying. But when it came time to apply for jobs and continue that trajectory, it just seemed a whole lot more like staplers and spreadsheets and a lot less like the beautiful equations that I had studied covering, you know, all the blackboards in the room from floor to ceiling. I felt like I was losing touch with the art and the artistry of it. And I did well in school and was invited to apply for a lot of international scholarships and fellowships. And when I won one, I felt like I had gotten to the top of the mountain and all I could see in the distance was more mountains. And I just couldn't climb anymore like that. To be quite honest, I had a bit of a panic attack and a downward spiral into a nice healthy dose of depression. And it was actually yoga and mindfulness practices were a huge catalyst for helping me figure out like what was going on, why I couldn't say yes to what was supposed to be the most amazing opportunity of my life thus far. And those are some of the things that helped me kind of get back on my feet, get my head on straight, and start going after a life that was maybe a little bit more self-directed than the one I had been living.
What made you to decide not to pursue that extravagant career?
It was one of those, it was like a moment of reckoning for me in that I felt like until that point in my life, I had largely been doing and valuing the things I had been told and rewarded for doing and valuing. I cared about the stuff that I thought I was supposed to care about, the stuff that, you know, an academic career would tell you to care about. And I'm not saying these are bad things to care about at all. They're wonderful things to value. But it was one of those moments where I discovered that maybe they weren't actually my values. Like maybe those things didn't mean as much to me as I thought they did or as I thought they should. And that was, I think, the source of panic for me, was discovering that the values I had maybe didn't feel like my own, but there was nothing to replace it with. I couldn't say to you, oh, I cared about this other thing so much more. It was a moment in my life where I was like, I don't care about this anymore, but I don't know what I'm supposed to care about instead. And this is one of the reasons why starting a yoga practice and a mindfulness practice were actually really helpful for me. I mean, beyond all of the lovely things that these practices do for your body and your mind, I feel like the most fundamental questions of yoga and of mindfulness are questions like, who am I? And what should I do in the world? What's worth caring about? And so it was extremely helpful to stumble into that world at that time in my life.
Were you already doing yoga and mindfulness practice, or did you start after your education, formal education?
No, I chucked my whole academic career, and as I said, fell into a nice downward spiral of depression for a little while. And it was actually a friend of mine who sort of watched me like flailing and drowning in my own misery, who said, maybe you ought to go try a yoga class. Which was like the most unlikely thing for me. I mean, when I grew up in America in the 1980s, we had this thing called the President's Fitness Challenge, which was like a government-sanctioned physical ability test that everybody did in grade school, where basically you sit down with your legs out straight and stretch your fingers as far as you can past your toes. And there's like a ruler that goes from zero to infinity. And I couldn't even reach my toes. And I thought, what business do I have doing a yoga class? But I did. I gave it a go. And it was pretty transformative for me. Although when I started, I absolutely hated it.
What kind of yoga was that?
I had the good fortune of, by blind chance, stumbling into a Kripalu yoga class. And that was a pretty good luck on my part. Because as I'm sure you know, there are all kinds of different styles of yoga. That's a toolbox with lots of different tools in it. But Kripalu yoga in particular, I feel is a really compassionate form of yoga, and one that was really perfect for me because it starts with it's grounded in a lot of self-acceptance, a lot of compassionate self-awareness. And it's not really about touching your toes or getting your leg behind your head or floating an inch up off the floor. It's about figuring out who you are and how you want to be in your world. So I stumbled into exactly the right place.
How old were you at that time?
It was early in my 20s, probably about 22.
That's very young age for starting yoga, actually. I did not know anything about yoga when I was 22.
Well, you know, at the time, if you had told me that my work in the world was going to be to teach yoga and mindfulness, the first thing I would have said is, what's yoga? And the second thing I would have said is, you're absolutely crazy. There's no way I would be caught dead doing that. But, you know, 20 years later, look, here I am.
And here we are doing this podcast. So when you decided not to pursue your academic career, what was your family reaction?
You know, I'd always been really fortunate to have an incredibly supportive family. I mean, a lot of my academic advisors thought I was absolutely crazy. Some of them were justifiably furious because the awards I turned down were not only important to me, but important to my university. But my family never flinched or second-guessed. You know, I remember both my mother and my father were like, well, we don't know what you're going to do,
but we believe in you and we know that you're going to figure out what you're going to do. And we've always seen you land on your feet and you got a good head on your shoulders. So we know you're going to figure it out. And that was actually hugely helpful. I feel like, you know, they were concerned, obviously. No one likes to see their child struggling, but their faith in me helped me have faith in me. I think about a lot now that I have kids.
What advice would you give to a college student, let's say 22-year-old college student?
You know, as I look back on that time, I feel like anyone at that age to have this mapped out and to know who they are in the kind of way I feel like you would want to know who you are if you're going to be making big life choices like that. And at the time, everything seemed so final, like so conclusive. And I guess the advice I would give to someone in a similar position as I look back is that the choices you make at that time, I think, are transformative ones, but they're not final ones. And I've seen my life change in the 20 years since then in incredible ways. Some of them were self-directed. Some of them had nothing to do with what I wanted. And I would say to a student at that point in their life, this is not your final choice. This is just one. So I think for a student at that point in their lives, I would just say that nothing's final.
Nothing is final. Yes. How did you fall in love with yoga? You talk about yoga and mindfulness. How did you really fall in love with that?
For me, it was, I remember it quite well, actually. In the end of the yoga classes that I would go to when we would lay down for Savasana, which at the time I just thought, oh, here's a nice little nap at the end of this class. I didn't realize what was actually taking place in that part of the class. But I would have this experience where nothing happened. And from where I was coming, from how it felt to be me, having a few moments that felt like nothing actually felt pretty good by comparison. But I had never felt anything like that, a moment where my mind was really quiet and I was really present and I could just be. And I kept coming back for that because it was really unlike anything else I'd experienced. And that was what, you know, beyond the stretching and the moving my body and the discovering how to manage my breathing, it was that feeling of being able to just be for a few minutes that made me fall in love.
If somebody has never done yoga, how should they start getting into yoga practice?
I would really encourage folks who are starting out to get really clear about what it is that they are looking for, what it is they want from a yoga practice. I think of like yoga is sort of like a Swiss Army knife, right? It has lots of different parts designed to do lots of different things. And I think it's absolutely okay to start with the things that are most important to you, to, you know, to use the parts of the tool that are most effective for you. And then to seek out the classes or the ways of studying that match up with what you value so that you're not just coming in and doing what you're told. You're not just coming in and taking on someone else's values, letting them tell you what to care about, but being clear about what you care about and seeing how a practice like that can help you.
When do you do yoga in your everyday life? What time of the day do you practice yoga?
Well, you know, once upon a time, before I had kids, I would like to get up and practice first thing in the morning, especially a meditation practice, which I often do either combined with physical asana or afterwards. I like the experience of being inside my body and my mind before the rest of the day can get in there. But now that I have kids, you know, when I wake up is not always my choice. And you know, like the kids want breakfast, and I do most of the parenting early in the morning in our family. So I try to find time in the middle of the day. I usually, one of the things that's helpful for me is I try to find two spots in the day so that I know, okay, I can practice at this time. And if something comes up, I've got a backup, which I often have to utilize. And if I get to practice at the first time, then the second time is free time and I can do a little more or just do something else. But I find that the busier and more complex my life gets, the more and more I need to have a backup plan.
What time in the morning do you do meditation?
So nowadays, I get the kids settled in with breakfast, and then I usually take a little time for myself. We have a little space out front in our brownstone in Brooklyn, and I planted a lot of flowers out there. And I like to sit on the bench and, you know, settle in and be able to hear the people in the cars going by and the day starting in the city. And I'll do my meditation practice there usually.
You mentioned that asana meditation earlier. What is asana meditation for our listeners who may not be aware of this?
Oh, sure. Well, in the tradition of Kripalu Yoga, where I started and continued to train and teach, there's a practice that we sometimes refer to as meditation in motion. It's a way of combining a traditional form of meditation, which we often think of as something you do sitting down with your eyes closed, but it's a way of doing something similar while your body is moving. So it's a way of just combining what we might typically think of as yoga, moving my body through space in a particular way, with meditation, organizing my attention in a particular way. So it's a way of doing both at the same time.
Is it necessary to do both yoga and meditation to live a calm, peaceful life?
No, I don't think it's necessary to do either of them. I know wonderful, calm, peaceful, fantastic folks who have never sat down on a yoga mat or a meditation cushion a day in their lives. And maybe that makes me a poor evangelist for yoga and mindfulness, but my hope is not that everybody do yoga or meditation. My hope is that everybody has something in their life that offers to them what I have found in these practices, which for me is a way of understanding who I am, the power and the limits of my body and my mind, and a way of getting really clear about what matters to me and doing that in the world as effectively as I can. And I think there are a million ways to do that. You know, I think is it the poet Rumi who says there's a million ways to kneel and kiss the ground? I just hope that everybody has at least one, hopefully many.
So this is something very interesting. I'm curious to ask about it, that you know a lot of people who do not do meditation, who don't have any yoga practice, and still they are happy and calm. Did you ever ask them what makes them calm and peaceful?
Yeah, this is something, you know, this is something I talk about a lot, especially because most of the people that I work with day to day are people who don't have any yoga or meditation practice before they meet me. You know, most of my work now is working in professional settings, hospitals, emergency responders, teachers, sharing these tools with people who work in pretty intense, high-stress environments and seeing if these tools can be helpful for them. But I try to make sure every time I go into work with those folks that we start from the understanding, like, I'm not trying to give you a magic cure to anything. These are useful tools, but they're not the only tools in the toolbox. And so when I talk to folks who feel like they've got that sort of calm, peaceful way of being in their world, the kinds of things I often hear from those people are, well, my friends and my family help me stay present and centered. You know, many of them say, I find something similar from my church, my community. Many of them say, through various forms of therapy that have helped them to acquire that kind of set of skills. So I think there are lots of ways of getting there. And as I said, I hope that we all have lots of different tools we can use, because my experience has been there's always going to come a day where the tool that you always used doesn't work anymore, or doesn't work the way you thought it was going to work. And it's good to have something else that you can reach for.
Is there any other mindfulness practice that you incorporate in your life?
There are a few. One of the things I do very often now is a form of meditation known as metta meditation, or well-wishing meditation. It's a way of cultivating kindness and compassion for oneself and friends and enemies and all sorts of people. I'll be honest with you, this is a form of meditation that, like, when it was first introduced to me, I thought, oh no, there's no way in hell that I'm going to be caught dead doing this. Like, it sounded so new agey and the magic of positive thinking. I just wanted nothing to do with it. Ironically, now it's the form of meditation that I practice most regularly. And it's actually been really widely researched. And it's one I incorporate most often, part of traditional mindfulness practice, but a little different than a lot of other meditations. And there are all kinds of other ways that I try to weave mindfulness into my daily life that aren't so formal. One of the things that I've been working on a lot lately, especially since we've all been at home together, and the blur and the lines between work life and home life are even blurrier, I try to make sure that when I'm with my children, I'm really with my children, that the phone goes off and away, that I'm removing distractions in the environment so that I can be as present with my kids as possible. And I'll be honest, oftentimes I fail at that as much as I succeed, but I feel it's really important, especially because I've worked with educators and kids enough to know that, like, if we want our children to be mindful, the most important thing we can do to teach them is to model that. That's how they learn. That's how they decide how they want to be in the world, by seeing how we are in the world. And so I feel like it's really important that I protect the time and the space in which we're together. And when it comes to the mindfulness practices beyond meditation that have become important to me, one that I've really been working with lately is to be present for my children as much as possible. And when I'm with them, to put away the phone, to minimize distractions, to be with them in a way that models how I hope they will learn and want to be in the world. Because I know from working with educators and working with kids, that's a big part, people around them doing it, acting in ways that reflect it. So it's not a formal thing, but it's a really important thing for me. And it, I hope, makes my relationship with my kids stronger and better, and gives them some sense of how they might want to move through their world full of technology and distraction.
How old are your kids?
My son is 7 and my daughter is 4.
Do you talk about mindfulness with your kids?
I would say yes, but not in a way that's formal at all. You know, we talk about how we manage our feelings. We talk about what it's like to, you know, what it's like to be present and focused. And we talk a lot about, you know, managing emotions. And I think that's part of a mindfulness practice, being able to recognize the waves of your experience and where you can adjust them and where you can be patient with them. I think that's absolutely part of mindfulness. It's also part of being a human being. And we talk about that. We talk about that all the time, you know, because they're kids. They have big feelings. And learning how to handle that is an important part of being a kid. Probably an important part of being a grown-up too.
So when you talk to your kids, do you use different terms, or you just use feeling, words like feelings or mindfulness? I'm curious to know, how do you teach mindfulness to a kid?
Well, as I said, I think that the most impactful way to teach mindfulness to a kid is to do it yourself as a grown-up. And I don't mean like sitting down to meditate in front of a 4-year-old. I mean, showing up for a kid in a way that is present and focused and intentional, open and curious and non-judgmental. You know, because kids' ability to self-manage and self-regulate is not fully developed. Like, they're neurologically incomplete, and they rely on the brains and the nervous systems of adults around them to learn this skill of managing themselves, which means, like, their ability to take care of themselves is a relationship. I think this is true as we're adults, but it's particularly true of kids. And so I really do believe the best way that we can teach kids mindfulness is to do it and be it. But to simply answer your question, no, when I'm with my kids or when I'm working in schools, I almost never use the word mindfulness. Like, my kids have seen me meditating. They know what it is, but we don't talk about it or do it in that formal way. But with my son in particular, like, we've talked about feeling your breathing, and we've played with how slowing your breath down and taking deeper breaths can help your body to calm down. But we don't try to dress it up in any particular way. We talk about it as just part of, like, being a human being and figuring out how to handle being a human being.
This is wonderful if we can teach mindfulness in different forms to kids. We can literally transform their lives to a greater good.
Well, and my big hope is that any kid who takes up any kind of practice like mindfulness feels like they have more choices in their lives. Like, I don't believe that I'm transforming kids with mindfulness. You know, I work a lot with the Department of Education here in New York City, and I don't believe that I'm transforming kids in that work. I believe that I'm giving kids tools that they might use to transform themselves. And that's what I hope for anyone who takes up yoga or mindfulness, is that they just feel like they have more choices as they move through the day, more freedom in how they operate.
Is there any mindfulness tool that you do not like to work with?
I mean, I feel like, you know, everybody has their favorite flavors of ice cream and the ones that they'll take a pack. But I have found value in most any mindfulness practice that I have encountered. There's certainly none that I would say, oh, no, no one should be using this. That's not been my experience. But I will say these tools aren't one size fits all. And for certain folks, certain tools are going to be more or less useful. And for some people, some tools might not feel appropriate. You know, I work a lot with people who have a history of trauma or work in environments where trauma is pretty extensive. And so all of them have episodes of what we call secondary trauma, where they have, you know, witnessed experiences of trauma, and that can be challenging. Oftentimes for folks who have trauma in their lives in a big way, something like just closing your eyes and focusing on the feel of your breathing, that can feel disorienting or uncomfortable in a way that might not be helpful. It might not be the place that we would want to start. And so we might, with folks like that, focus on the sounds and the space around you, something more external. Focus on the feeling of your feet on the ground or your body against the chair, something that's supporting you, making you feel really stable. So I think it's a question of, like, where's the front door? Where do you want to what's the most appropriate place to begin? And this has become really important for me in all of the work that I do. I want to make sure that the tools I'm using meet people where they are and don't ask them to stretch who they are a whole lot in order to give these practices a try. I want to make it as accessible as possible. And I don't feel like that's dumbing it down or oversimplifying it. I feel like that's a way of beginning compassionately so that people can be who they are and find some value in a practice. And then we might try different ways, more challenging ways as time goes by. Does that make sense?
It does. I really love how you explain that, meeting people where they are and these tools. These are the same tools, breath awareness, body awareness. It just, they are not meant for everybody in every situation. Maybe somebody who is going through a trauma, they need to seek a mental therapist, a mental health professional.
Oh, yeah. And I've worked quite a bit with folks who are, as I said, going through trauma or who have, you know, different issues that they identify with. And every single time when I'm working with someone who is seeing a therapist or a physician for any issue, I always am clear to say what we're doing should work alongside those things. It's not a substitute. Hopefully it's a complement. And if it doesn't feel like it's supporting what you're already doing, we should stop or change what we're doing. Like those things come first.
Yes, mindfulness is about enhancing the quality of our life. Meditation, yoga, they are not just a fashion statement. They are not a to-do list.
Yeah, I like the way you put it. Not a fashion statement. That's absolutely true.
You know, on Instagram, we see a lot of yoga poses these days, you know, like the fashion statement behind that. There is nothing wrong with that, but you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Yeah. I feel like yoga and mindfulness are both having their pop culture moment, and there's so much hype around them right now. And I'll be honest, sometimes I see these things and it makes me want to roll my eyes. I'm not going to call out anything specifically because I don't think that's fair or kind, but I'm willing to tolerate all of the stuff that seems to me, if it means that it's easier for one more nurse or firefighter or teacher to pick up these tools and make use of them in a way that helps them do their work in the world and feel like they're okay. And they can continue to make the changes and serve in the way they want to serve. Like, I will tolerate all the nonsense if it means to do the good stuff that I find really essential.
Yes. And Sam, you
I'm
talk
not
about
by those things.
So you talk about pursuit of happiness in your work. Could you walk us through that?
Many people, one of the reasons that they end up doing something like a yoga or a meditation practice, at the end of the day, boils down to wanting to feel better. Whether that means learning to touch your toes or stay calm or find enlightenment in this lifetime, like folks want to feel happy. And that's a weird word. It's one of those words that I have a sense we all walk around feeling like we know it. But if you poke it and push a little bit and ask someone to really define it, it's a really hard concept to define. And it seems radically subjective. Like, you know, there's research that's emerged in the last 10 or 15 years exploring how the emotion of happiness shows up in the brain. Like, we can map it reasonably well with an fMRI. So you put someone in an fMRI, when they're feeling an emotion of great happiness, we can see how the brain lights up. But if you laid down in an fMRI right now and felt really happy, and someone in the lab looked at your brain scan and turned to you and said, "Oh, Nishant, I'm so sorry. You're not feeling happiness. According to our readings, you're actually full of despair right now." Like, you would look at them and be like, "You're absolutely crazy," because you're actually the only one in a position to know what you're feeling. And we can't get around that. Like, no amount of technology or measurement, none of the tools of science can break the raw fact that your happiness is, in a sense, one of the most subjective things we could ask about. And so I don't try to define happiness for other folks. I think that's a foolish errand. But I do try to get folks interested in how they define their own happiness, how they experience and express their own well-being. It's my opinion that too often we let other people define for us what we ought to value what ought to make us feel good, what ought to be important in a life. And my hope is that we can examine those things and pull apart that question of happiness to get at some kind of core or foundation that lets me step into the world knowing this is what I value. Maybe I value it in part because it's a part of my family. It's a part of my work. That's okay. I'm not saying we should have a happiness that's not connected to our world. I don't know that that's possible. That's not something I would encourage for myself or anyone necessarily. But I think it's important to be able to affirm those connections or push back against those connections so that we have a real sense of agency and ownership about our happiness, mm-hmm. our well-being, and our path in the world.
Sam, is it possible that we can elevate our happiness level?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Absolutely. So there are aspects of happiness that are genetic and environmental. And this is what we see when we look at differences between groups. You know, there is a component of happiness that is genetic. We play the cards that we're dealt. There are aspects of happiness that are environmental, part of the culture and the circumstances we live in. But there are also aspects of our happiness that we can change as time goes by. And a lot of that has to do with things like how we relate to one another. Actually, the quality of our social connection is probably the most substantial aspect of happiness and well-being that any of us could influence or change over a lifetime. The quality of connection, not the quantity of connection. So like mm-hmm. for folks who are listening, don't go check your Instagram followers or your Facebook friends, because it's not about the number. It's about how we connect and engage with the web of people in our lives. And for some of us, maybe we just need one or two good friends over the course of a lifetime. And some of us, in some circumstances, we might feel like we just need a whole tribe at our back. But that's one of the biggest ones, and there are many others. But the good news for all of us is that's a needle that can move as time goes by.
Yes. And I would love to talk about your book, Yoga and the Pursuit of Happiness. So you divide this book into two parts, the map, the journey. So in this part two, the journey, you have three components: look within, look around, look back. Could you walk us through that? What is this? Look within, look around, look back.
Well, one of the things that I talk about a lot in the book, and one of the things that seems to have been really helpful for the folks that I work with, is just coming to understand the nature of the mind and the nature of our attention. You know, like if we're interested in this question of being happy, that's going to be an emotional experience that we live in. That's going to be something that's embodied. And so it's important to know like the equipment that we're working with. So one of the first things that I think is important to acknowledge is like our attention is inherently limited. Our conscious attention can basically be in one place at one time. And that makes our attention a really precious natural resource. Sometimes our attention is focused in the present moment. Actually, in the research around attention, they find that about half of the time, our minds are wandering. We're not thinking about what's going on in the present moment. We're wandering into the past. We're planning into the future. We're putting attention in a fantasy that doesn't exist now or then or anywhere. And this is not bad. It's just how the mind works. It's what the mind does. So if we're interested in a kind of happiness or well-being that is pervasive, that spreads into as many aspects of our existence as possible, then it would make sense to me that we need to have ways of working with happiness when the mind is looking back. Like as we look back over the course of our lives, can we develop compassion, a capacity for forgiveness, an ability to acknowledge our mistakes and the mistakes of those around us, and also an ability to savor and recall, sometimes even with nostalgia, the good aspects of our past, and to make peace with the aspects of our past that are not pleasant. And equally important, can we look ahead? Can we look into the future? Can we plan and pursue goals in a way that is effective, in a way that reflects our values? And at last, can we also have an awareness that is able to sit and be at home and be at peace with what's going on in the present moment? And can we also have the kind of awareness that is not just going to sit and take what comes, but be able to agitate for change, to be a good activist, to be, you know, really working for the betterment of our world? And so that's why I divided into pieces about looking back, looking forward, and looking right at the here and now. Does that make sense?
It does. Would you say that looking right now is kind of a gratitude?
Well, not necessarily. I mean, look, right now where I am in Brooklyn, 5 blocks from my house, there are people marching in the streets because they really have problems with what's happening right now. And I share many of those problems. So I think it is, I don't find it appropriate to tell myself, well, I ought to be grateful for the problems that are existing in my culture right now. But at the same time, even as those marches are taking place, even as, you know, a pandemic is sweeping our country and all around the world, I should be able to acknowledge the blessings that I do have, that I'm privileged to have. I shouldn't push those away. Or can I have an attention that is fluid, that is able to express gratitude for the blessings and the privileges I have, be able to experience that fully, and then be able to turn right around and go march in the streets and make change in the world for the things that are not okay, and to not pretend that they're okay. And this is actually I don't want to get on a soapbox, but this is a huge problem I have with so much of the yoga and the mindfulness communities, this notion that we ought to have an acceptance that spreads everywhere. We ought to be at peace no matter what, period, full stop. And I think that's an unfair caricature on my part to a certain extent, but I don't want a sense of peacefulness that spreads everywhere, period, full stop. I want a sense of peace where it is okay for us to be at peace. And I want to be able to work for change around the many things in our world that need to change, and to be able to support other people in working to change the aspects of their world that need to change.
I really love how you explain that acknowledgement and not just being grateful for whatever is going on. If we have to take any action, we have to take any action. Then how do you find gratitude and appreciation of whatever we have?
Well, you know, I think there are circumstances where gratitude and happiness is not the answer. Like, I'll give you an example.
Please.
Right after I wrote this book, I was asked to do a lot of like radio interviews and things like that. Frankly, I was asked to do a lot of interviews with people who had not read the book that they were coming to talk to me about, which is often how it happens when you're doing radio interviews, and that's fine. But I sat down to do this interview, and the first thing this gentleman said to me was, "So tell me what are the secrets to being happy no matter what happens?" And I said, "I don't think that's possible. I think that's crazy. Like at a time like this, in a world like the one we live in, I would say if you're happy no matter what is happening, that's insane. And that's not what I would advocate for."
Does it mean that we have to be unhappy? Whatever is going on into our world these days, are you saying that we do not have to be happy about it?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I would say we don't have to be happy about everything that's going on. And furthermore, I would say there is a kind of happiness, a quality of happiness that we don't get to have, and I mean all of us, we all don't get to have when we live in a world that is struggling the way our world is struggling. And don't hear me wrong, I'm not pessimistic about this. I'm actually incredibly hopeful. What I believe is that we're here to wake each other up and help each other out. And I don't get to be happy in a certain way if all of my neighbors are suffering and struggling. That's a kind of binding that we get put on us when we live in a world that is struggling and suffering.
Yeah, great, Sam. I love your thoughts. I love your opinion, and which is conflicting to my belief, but I really love how you're explaining that. This is not something woo-woo that you're talking about. We get to be happy no matter what. We get to be peaceful no matter what. But it doesn't mean that we get to be super unhappy, that we become miserable. Do you feel that?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think it's important that we all support each other in waking up and growing and creating the kind of world that we want to live in together. And we have to be honest about that. Like, we have to be really sober as we look at ourselves and our world. And my hope is that everybody along the way can find blessings. I also hope that every single one of us has the kind of awareness that allows us to look at ourselves. And I'm going to get up off my meditation cushion and go do something to help change that.
And before I ask you my last question, Sam, for this conversation, I would love to ask you, what have you gained from meditation and yoga practice?
I feel the things I've found most are an ability to see myself in different ways. And I feel like that kind of self-awareness, that different perspective, is an important foundation for deciding how I want to be in the world.
Wonderful, wonderful, Sam. And so before we close this conversation, do you have any recommendation, closing thought, or anything you would like to share with our listeners?
No, it feels pretty complete for me. I really appreciate having the chance to chat with you and share some ideas.
Thank you. Amazing. And where can our listeners find you online, Sam?
Oh, I have a website. It's called samchaseyoga.com. I don't really do social media, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter. I have never really been a part of those communities. It's just never been my style, but I have a website and people can learn more about me and my work there if they'd like to.
Great, great. Thank you so much, Sam. It was wonderful. Different conversation. I really loved it. Thank you for listening to this podcast episode today. If you did enjoy this, please subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts, or you can visit https://nishantgarg.me, nishantgarg.me. You can also share this episode with your loved ones to help them live a fulfilled life. You are not alone in this journey. We all struggle in life. There is no shame in talking about it. I go through my highs and lows. I get depressed, and these practices help me in living a resilient life. You can also do this. You got this. Don't judge yourself. You are doing the best you can. And thank you so much again.